Welcome, everyone, to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley, a national news and talk program dedicated to military veterans issues. And now, your hosts, David Corey and Richard Hurley.
Welcome to the Veterans News Hour for November the 20th, 2017. This is David Corey along with my co-host, Richard Hurley. Thanks for joining us this evening. Hello, Richard.
Hey, good evening, David, and hello to everybody out there. Tonight we have a very special guest, Mr. John Wells. He is the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Military Veterans Advocacy, which has a national agenda and national impact in helping to improve VA benefits to veterans and their families. Before he joins us in a moment, though, I want to remind everyone that this is a call-in show that welcomes your views, comments, and questions. So you can call us at any time during the show at 1-888-627-6008. Again, the toll-free number is 1-888-627-6008. Back to you, David.
Thank you, Richard. Our guest tonight to discuss some important issues affecting veterans and their families is John Wells, the executive director of a nonprofit organization called Military Veterans Advocacy. Our listeners may recall that John was on our show on May 29th, and he's back with us. We're pleased to have him back on our show tonight. He's a lawyer and one of the premier veteran advocates in the nation. He's also a retired Navy commander with extensive career experience as a surface warfare officer. He served in the Navy on active duty from 1972 until 1994, and over the course of his career, he was assigned to six different ships and several shore commands. He was qualified in all aspects of surface warfare, including command at sea. Of relevance to his second career, Mr. Wells attended law school at night while still on active duty. He was a member of the Law Review staff and contributed to several law school publications. Upon his retirement from the military, he settled in Louisiana and opened a general law practice that emphasized military and veterans law. He has represented military members and veterans throughout the country, and he has extensive experience in both state and federal courts, and he travels often to Washington, D.C. for cases there. So it's our privilege to have John Wells on our show once again. Without further ado, I welcome John to the Veterans News Hour. How are you tonight, John?
Hey, doing pretty good, David. How about yourself?
Oh, very well.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Yep, it's our privilege. I know we have a lot to talk about, including getting the latest on the Blue Water Navy benefits for Vietnam veterans, benefits for veterans who served in Guam, the impact of the new appeals law, the subject of toxic exposure, and some other issues. So why don't we start, though, first with if you could give us an overview of your organization and its overall goals for the benefit of our listeners who may have missed our show back in November. In May.
Military Veterans Advocacy is a nonprofit. We're a 501c3 tax-exempt organization based down here in southeast Louisiana. And we do three major efforts. The first is litigation. We will take litigation on behalf of active duty members or military members or former service members, and bring suits against the United States or the Secretaries of the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, or Secretary of Veterans Affairs. And what we're trying to do with these suits is to try to either force benefits by having the courts order the benefits, or in some cases trying to stop the deprivation of benefits. Our second main effort is legislation, and we spent time in Congress. I traveled to D.C., spent about 10, 12 weeks a year up there, and work on different veterans legislation. We're instrumental in stopping some of the worst parts of the appeals reform litigation that went, or legislation that went through, and I've got more to say about that later. We've also been able to get some benefits, including the Fairness for Veterans Act, which requires the Discharge Review Boards to give credence and a liberal consideration to people trying to upgrade their discharges if there's a post-traumatic stress or traumatic brain injury type of diagnosis. Because unfortunately, we've lost a lot of people on other than honorable discharges that actually had post-traumatic stress that was either not identified or ignored, and so they put these folks out with misconduct. And
right, they're not getting the help they need. Yeah,
that's right. And a lot of those make up our 22-a-day suicides as well. The third issue that we have is education, and we do that through social media outreach, through op-eds. I usually write several op-eds a quarter for the Hill, a newspaper out of Washington, D.C., and we do continuing legal education. I just finished last week doing a three-hour continuing legal education for about 15 lawyers down here in southeast Louisiana. Done another one up in Washington, D.C., and we will travel to conduct the three-hour continuing legal education, which fulfills the VA's requirement. There's a requirement that an attorney does 3 hours every other year, and our course will fulfill that requirement. And, you know, then we always also go out and speak with civic clubs and so on and so forth to let folks know what's going on. We're pushing veterans courts down here in Louisiana. We've established one here in St. Tammany Parish, which is outside New Orleans, and our next move is to go up and try to get one set up in East Baton Rouge. So we have a number of issues going, a number of things that we're trying to do, and whenever we get a chance, we also will do practice a little law here and there as well.
Yeah, it sounds like you're super busy. I know Richard Hurley has some questions for you, so over to you, Richard.
Hey, good evening there, John.
Richard?
Yeah, I have a question regarding the Vietnam vets and that are not covered by the Agent Orange presumption. So what is the latest on the issue of the Blue Water Navy benefits for these veterans?
Yeah, well, it started out about 30 days ago. It was definitely looking up. I met with Secretary Shulkin on October 24th, and a few hours before that meeting, he testified before Congress and said that he felt the Blue Water Navy folks had been waiting too long, and that, in fact, we should go ahead and get the benefits. And, you know, you're kind of on a natural high coming out of that one. On November 2nd, however, Chairman Roe from Tennessee brought the bill that would restore the benefits up to what they call a markup session at the House Veterans Affairs Committee. Okay, and unfortunately, well, the intent was to go ahead and pass it out of committee. Okay, unfortunately, Congressman Walz, who's the Tim Walz out of Minnesota, is the ranking member, and he opposed the offset that was built into it. Unfortunately, when you add new benefits, you've got to find an offset for it. And as a result of that, everything went kaput, and they wound up tabling it. So we're sitting here saying, that's not a good deal. In fact, I'm going back up next month to see if we can get everything restarted again. Later on in the month, on November the 16th, we had a case that was pending at the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. And we had brought what's called the Administrative Procedures Act review against the VA exclusion policy. We felt we had jurisdiction. In fact, we'd taken similar case to the D.C. Circuit, and they said, yeah, got to go to the Federal Circuit. So we went to the Federal Circuit, and they just came out in a 2-to-1 decision and said, nope, sorry, you don't have jurisdiction. And what we were trying to do was bring the case based on a group of veterans, the Blue Water Navy Vietnam Veterans Association, and again, get this Administrative Procedures Act review. What the court has told us is that we have to come up with a individual litigant, okay, who has been denied benefits, and then they will hear the case and at least get to the merits of it. So luckily, we've just finished briefing one of those, and we're hoping to get oral argument on it, you know, after the first of the year. But the other issue, quite frankly, is we think the court was an error on this. We felt that there was jurisdiction. So I'm currently working on preparing a petition for rehearing, or what they will call rehearing en banc, which is the full court, to try to see if we can get the full court to reverse what that three-judge panel said. Now, if that fails, then we're also looking at filing a petition for certiorari with the Supreme Court of the United States. And we think we've got a pretty good basis for that, because the Federal Circuit decision seems to be contrary to the decision of other circuits. And one of the things that the Supreme Court likes to do is look at cases where there's a split in the circuits. So we've actually been talking to some of the folks that some of the law firms that may be assisting us on a pro bono basis who are specialized in Supreme Court petitions, and they, like us, think that this may be a good case to bring up. On the other side of it, of course, the Supreme Court only takes about 1% of the cases that where petitions are filed, so the odds are against us. But, you know, I think it's probably, in this case, it's worth a try. The other thing that we're doing, quite frankly, is trying to go back to Secretary Shulkin. We think he's on board. And, you know, this October meeting was the second meeting I'd had with him. I met with him in April as well. And we just sent him a letter today and just said, you know, hey, we really need to do this because, Mr. Secretary, you can do it with a stroke of the pen. Now, what we're hearing is that the Office of Management and Budget is pushing back on it. And that's based on the cost of the bill. Congressional Budget Office has come out and said the bill will cost $1.1 billion over 10 years. The VA has estimated about four times that. OMB is apparently resisting it. And we think that's a credible report, because in 2015, after the Gray versus McDonald decision, where the Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims basically told the court, or told the VA to rewrite their regulation, we've confirmed that they had planned on granting or extending the presumption out to the bays and the harbors, and it was the Office of Management and Budget people at that time that pushed back and said, no, you can't do it. And I need to emphasize, this is not a Democrat thing or a Republican thing. It's not an Obama or a Trump issue. The folks at the OMB that we're talking about are the professional staffers or the, you know, the professional bean counters. And as we're finding more and more, it just all comes back to money. You know, we can spend
billions of dollars on other things,
but we can't seem to do that to take care of the veterans. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to talk over you there.
No. You know, I was sitting there listening to you go on, I've always maintained that it's all about the money. I was just about to say, it's the same old thing again. It's about the money, not about taking care of our vets.
But what people seem to forget is that Congress has a constitutional duty to raise and maintain an army and a navy, and inherent in that is to take care of the veterans. So, you know, they'll go out and spend all kinds of money on a bunch of other things. You know, you can take your pick which side of the aisle you're on to find something they waste money on, but, geez, the bottom line is there's no money to take care of the veterans, but there's plenty of money to waste on everything else. So, you know, we're hoping on this December trip that we can get some good feedback from the congressional staffs, who actually were pretty optimistic and supportive on it when we met with them in October. But, you know, we're just going to keep pushing it. We're just going to keep pushing it in court. We're going to keep pushing it in the Congress. And, you know, we're going to keep putting pressure on the VA itself. I did have a letter going to President Trump addressing him directly, and that's supposed to be, you know, hand-delivered to him. And unfortunately, I don't know if it has been delivered yet, so I can't really go into the details of what it said. But basically, we asked for him to overrule OMB and overrule everybody else and just give us the benefits.
And in the meantime, John, these Vietnam vets, who are Blue Water Vietnam vets, are dying.
Well, that's right. And
you know,
just,
I mean, if the government just continues doing what they're doing, which is my personally, I believe this is their whole MO, which is we'll just keep putting off, and eventually all these Blue Water Vietnam vets will be dead, and we don't have to pay anybody.
Well, you know, there's a lot of people think that, and you know, there's a lot of support for that. But you know, it's not just the Blue Water vets. You know, Blue Water has kind of taken the lead on a lot of things because they had some unique science, and you know, Military Veterans Advocacy was formed out of advocacy for the Blue Water. But we've expanded quite a bit on that. You know, I mean, we're taking a very hard look at Guam, and we found that there was definite instances of spraying for at least 10 years on Guam. We've gotten some reports from the EPA showing that there's a higher concentration in some areas on Guam than there is in South Vietnam. Anderson Air Force Base there, which was home to the B-52 bombers, has an area where there was 19,000 parts per million of dioxin found. I mean, and that's just unbelievable high. It's gotten into the aquifers. It got into the water systems of the ships that made a port call into Guam, and a lot of ships did. And it's just another way that people were contaminated. The folks that the Air Force guys, the Marines, and the Navy folks on Guam are pretty much got the same, you know, concentrated shot of Agent Orange as the guys in shore in that actually fought in country in South Vietnam. It's unbelievable. Then you look at Thailand. Senator Bozeman just put in a bill to cover the Thailand vets. There is some coverage, but it's not near enough. Laos, Cambodia, Panama, Okinawa, Korea, and, you know, constant other places. And, you know, I mean, it's just gotten to be unbelievable. You know, in my first meeting with Secretary Shulkin in April, you know, we mentioned the fact that there were a few hundred World War II veterans that had been exposed to mustard gas. And that was part of an experiment. They were volunteers, but then the experiment was classified, and these guys were basically not given any kind of benefits. And I mentioned that to Shulkin, and I said, hey, you guys are actually opposing the bill. Senator McCaskill had a bill, the bill in Congress that would grant the benefits. And his eyebrows went up, and he said, we are? And I said, yeah, you are. And to his credit, a few months later, he changed the position, and that bill was signed into law by President Trump this past August. But good Lord, that was 70 years down the road. Is everybody going to have to wait 70 years to get their benefits? Right. What about the radiation, folks? Mm-hmm. I mean, we used to march people towards the mushroom clouds, for God's sakes. I mean, you talk about stupid. Oh, well, we want to see how radiation affected the troops. Well, it made them sick, and it gave them cancer, and they died younger. That's how it affected them. And everybody should have already known that from the time in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It was just stupid. Now, today, even in Iraq and Afghanistan, even to this day, we still have open-air burn pits, and we still have troops birthed downwind of the open-air burn pits. And, you know, are these guys going back to Iraq and Afghanistan going to have to wait 70 years for their benefits? God, I hope not.
Right.
Sorry, you got me on a rant there.
No, and I was thinking, you know, we do a lot of work on the burn pits. We have a lot of veterans who are burn pit exposure, and David's been instrumental in putting and backing this burn pit documentary that's out. And, you know, the one thing I just keep thinking every time we go to one of these showings is that this is this generation's Agent Orange. And how long is it going to take? I mean, it's clear that these vets have these respiratory issues, and it's being ignored.
Well, we're going to have to do some kind of situation to solve the funding. I put an article out last week in the Hill, talked about it. You know, we've been proposing a $10 fee added to every tax return. That would raise $25 billion over 10 years and should cover most of the toxic exposures. We tried to sell that in Congress, get a lot of interest, but, you know, nobody's been willing to actually introduce it, and the Ways and Means Committee, every time they see us coming, you know, they lock the door because they don't really want to talk to us about it. But, you know, the other thing is you look at what happens toward the end of every fiscal year. All the money that's been held back as retainages, and that's usually about 10%, gets dumped on the agencies, middle of August, first part of September, spend it or lose it. How much of that money is wasted? You know, enough, more than enough to raise $25 billion over 10 years. Hell, you could probably do that in just the VA and Department of Defense alone. I'm sorry, I said a bad word. I shouldn't have. But, you know, there's money there, and it can be recouped. It can be recovered. And I'm getting just so uncomfortable sitting there and talking across the desk from these congressmen, because every time they start saying, well, pay-as-you-go act, and we got to find an offset, and I give them some of these proposals, and they all look at me like, oh, well, yeah, okay, that is money is wasted, but, gee, there's nothing we can do about it. Well, for gosh sakes, you're the United States Congress. You're the ones who appropriate the money. You can put the controls on it. You can put the oversight on it so that that money that's been held back as a retainage is either going to be used for a good, effective program, end-of-the-year program, or it can be recouped and put into some sort of trust fund for these veterans.
Yeah. John, if I can interject, this is David. When I was on active duty, I saw what you described in the Air Force, which was get close to the end of the fiscal year, and it was spend the money or lose it and get less money next year. And it's just part of a system that needs to be changed. As you said, if Congress won't do it, who's going to? I think back to history when then U.S. Senator Harry Truman, before he became vice president and president, he made his name in politics in Washington, D.C. by going around exposing military fraud, waste, and abuse. I think there needs to be some people that do the same thing. But let me ask you about a topic that we had touched on a few months ago, but I think now, since we last talked, it's now law, and that's the appeals legislation. I want to get your thoughts about that and its likely impact. And I know you mentioned a few minutes ago, already having your organization having some impact on addressing some of the problems of that legislation.
Well, the thing that we worry was require the VA to provide regulations on how you can transfer back and forth between one docket and another. As you may remember, the idea was for three dockets. I think the final Senate bill said two, but the VA is still talking about three dockets, and to me that's completely ridiculous. But once you were locked into one docket, you couldn't change. Well, we worked with Amanda Meredith, who is now Judge Meredith on the Court of Appeals Veterans Claim, very wonderful lady, and she basically forced the committee to agree to the fact that there had to be some way to transition between the dockets. The other thing is, of course, once the appeal is filed, you lose your duty to assist. Now, the duty to assist is not near as good as the discovery we enjoy in the normal practice of law, but, you know, it's better than nothing. Well, they set it up so that as soon as the notice of disagreement is filed, that's the end of the duty to assist. Well, that's the point where most attorneys come into the system. So, again, worked with Amanda, and we kind of build up the supplemental claim idea. Supplemental claim is basically saying, instead of filing a notice of disagreement, you file a supplemental claim saying, here, I've got some additional evidence, blah, blah, blah. And that additional evidence can be an affidavit. It can be just about anything. Okay. And once you file the supplemental claim, you still have the duty to assist, and you can go ahead and use that duty to assist to get through the supplemental claim process, and then from there go file the notice of disagreement, which is kind of defeats the intent of the whole process, which was to speed things up, but it's the only way that you can continue the due process. So, you know, the kicker is, or the tipper maybe I should say, is don't file the notice of disagreement, file a supplemental claim.
And if you file the supplemental claim, you can still flesh everything out. What I see happening is that they're going to move the backlog from the appeals backlog into the supplemental claim. So there's an overused hackneyed expression, rearranging deck chairs on the Titanic, but you know, I think that's what we have right now is we're just going to be moving the appeal backlog from the appeals to the supplemental claims. Now, when I met with Secretary Shulkin in October, I gave him a 90-day letter. I scratched out all the identifying information, redacted that. And I said, Mr. Secretary, this is what you guys sent out. He'd never seen one before. I said, what does this mean? It says 90 days are until we make a decision to submit new evidence. What's my evidence cutoff date? And he looks at me like, I don't know. And I said, and by the way, what's the issue on this appeal? They don't bother to tell you in the 90-day letter. And he said,
right.
That's a good point. And I said, because sometimes you can have several different appeals going up, and often you don't find out until you show up at the Board of Veterans Appeals hearing what your issue is. I mean, I have the number of the congressional line for the board, and I use it, but they're getting tired of me using it and tell me I can't use it anymore. So, and you call the direct number, and, you know, you can't get anything. But it's... And I said, and by the way, this is all stubby pencil. This is all sent through the U.S. mail. We're still not using electronic filing. And I mentioned, and David, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Merit Systems Protection Board's e-appeal system. But
it's been 25 years when I was on active duty that I did any of those cases. So I have to say I'm pretty rusty as far as what their latest is. But go ahead.
But it's a good system. You basically file it. You know, convert everything to PDF, and you upload it, and boom, it's emailed out to everybody. So it's like PACER or CMECF, but it's just tailored towards the administrative tribunal instead of to a court system. But it works well, and I mentioned that to him. So he did tell me that when I come up the next time, which will be in about 3 weeks, he wants to get me with Cheryl Mason, who's the new chair of the Board for Correction or the Board of Veterans Appeals. The fact that we have a new chair is good. We haven't had one for about 6 years now, and you know, we've contacted Cheryl and done some initial liaison. So we're going to try and get an hour or so of her time when I go back up to D.C. the week of December 11th. And what we're hoping to do is sit down and say, you know, here's how the other federal adjudication systems do it. If you do this, you can, definitely accelerate the process, make it more efficient, actually get the right things uploaded. I mean, you know how it is in VBMS now. They scan stuff at random. They might scan the second half of the document first, and maybe you got the first of the document, 200 pages later, or maybe it gets scanned in somebody else's record. So, but if you be in the situation where the attorney or the VSO is actually doing the uploading, it's going to make it a less bulky record and certainly a lot more efficient. I don't know Cheryl Mason. I watched her confirmation hearing, but I don't know her. Hopefully we can sit down and get some things done. The secretary did seem to be interested in some of the things that we brought up, but things like scheduling orders and so on and so forth, we still believe, and the Federal Bar Association agrees with us on this, that we need to take these so-called veterans law judges, who are not really judges, Congress has never designated them as judges, and replace them with administrative law judges. That's probably going to be a bridge too far at this point, but, you know, at least something an issue that we can raise. And I found out a very interesting thing. These board members who are making the decisions, they're unionized. We've got unionized lawyers now. Okay.
Wow.
They have to decide 139 cases a year, I think it is. Jeez, I need a job like that. That's unbelievable. I mean, even taking time off for weekends, that's less than one case a day, and they've got three or four veteran staff attorneys for each board member. you know, to who actually do all the grunt work. But, you know, there's so many things that we could do. Just have the staff attorney who's going to draft the opinion attend the hearing so that they're not looking at a transcript 30 or 60 or 90 days later and saying, gee, I wonder what this means, you know. They can never pick up the flavor of the hearing if they're not sitting there to do it, in my opinion. But we'll see. We'll give it a shot, and, you know, they may call the VA police and throw me out, or maybe they'll listen to some of it. You don't know.
Well, good luck in that meeting in a few weeks. It'll be interesting to see what comes of that. I mean, I think it's incredible that those judges only required to, like you just said, render, you know, what's that, less than three decisions a week. And how are they ever going to get through the horrendous backlog that they have? What the VA calls these legacy appeals, you know.
Especially when 80, and it used to be 70% of the cases were remanded back by the court. And it's not 70% anymore. It's 80%. So we're going in the wrong direction. It's, you know, and these folks have got to understand they have to make the right decision, and they've got to do it the first time. And that's the only way we're going to get control of all these appeals. But, you know, one of the interesting things that came out of the Blue Water Navy case and that just came down from the Federal Circuit, and if you look at it, it's actually listed under Gray versus Shulkin because it was our case was consolidated with the case of Robert Gray, who was the same guy of Gray versus McDonald fame. And they just consolidated them for oral argument for the opinion. But they did say Board of Veterans' Appeals are not bound by the M21 manual. You know, I mean, we've said this before, and there's been some case law on it before, but they came out and just reiterated that, specifically said, you know, if the VA thinks that they can get around, Administrative Procedures Act review or Section 502 review by putting things in the M21-1 manual instead of doing the notice and comment requirements under the Administrative Procedures Act, they'd better think twice, because that manual has no force of law. It's only binding on the VBA employees at the regional office and not at the board, and certainly not at the Court of Appeals or Veterans Claims. And the other thing that we took from that decision is that the Gray versus McDonald decision, 2015, they basically reiterated that it was still good law, okay? And they did nothing to change Gray or to mess with Gray. So, you know, I think all the decisions, not what we wanted, they did throw us a couple of bones.
I see. Let me go back, if I could, to your thoughts on the impact of this VA appeals legislation, because as I understand it, the VA has already started a process to start implementing it, and it's supposed to go into effect, I think, in February of 2019, about a year and a half from now. For our audience, which is primarily not made up of lawyers, what sort of general information or education insight could you offer them as far as perhaps what they can expect, what questions they should be asking? I know you can't give case-specific advice over over the show, but anything you can impart, any wisdom you can impart about that to our listeners?
Well, the implementation program they're starting is the RAMP program, and R-E-M-P, and I forget exactly what it stands for. Basically, they come in and say, hi, you have been selected. Would you like to go into the new process? And my best advice is to say no. No way, okay? Because first off, they aren't completely set up to do it, and secondly, what they're trying to do is get people to basically push their appeals forward without a hearing and without any additional evidence, and that makes it very easy for the board to deny the appeals. And frankly, this is what they're trying to do, is by speed up the process by making it easier to deny appeals. As far as the process itself, the only thing I can do is refer you to Dante's Divine Comedy, or Tragedy, whichever it was, and assign the sign above the entrance to hell, all hope abandon ye who enter here. And that's about what it is, okay? Because if you don't watch it, they're going to trip you up, and the next thing, you know, and what they're going to do is they're going to come out and tell you, oh, this will speed up your appeal. And everybody says, oh, good, I don't have to wait 3 years. And it goes up, and it gets, boom, denied. No due process,
right.
No hearing, no more opportunity to submit evidence. It's a key provision is you really have to request the hearing. Once you request the hearing, you can submit new evidence. You get a chance to go before the board member, and they have to look you in the eye or look in, at least look into the video camera. You know, it's harder to disapprove somebody when you actually see them. It's not impossible. They've shown that. But it is a little bit harder. But more importantly, you keep the record open so that you can submit evidence, and you can do that for... I believe it's 90 days after the hearing, okay? Otherwise, you're going to find yourself completely cut off, and they're going to make the same decision based on the record that went to the regional office. And, folks, I've got to tell you, get a lawyer when you come up to the appeals. I'm not, and please, I'm not really accepting a lot of new cases right now, so I'm not trying to feather my own nest. But get a lawyer, because the VSOs, they're very good on technical things and on minor things and so on and so forth. They don't know how to prepare a litigation package. And if you lose at the Board of Veterans' Appeals and it has to go higher to the Court of Appeals of Veterans' Claims or the Federal Circuit, the case is going to be decided on whatever record goes to the Board of Veterans' Appeals. So you need to make sure that the litigation package is completely developed. I'll use Blue Water for an example, okay? There's a lot of stuff running around the Internet right now, and white papers and memos and well-documented studies by people who really have no idea what you need to do to set up a legal brief. On the other hand, there are some good things that are referenced on our website in my congressional testimony that can set up the record so that you have a chance to prevail once we get up the line. That's why we've got a couple of Blue Water cases pending, several actually in the Court of Appeals of Veterans Claims, several others at the board. And, you know, I think we're getting to the point that we can actually start winning some of these Blue Water cases at the board. That's another reason why I'm trying to meet with the Board of Veterans Appeals people, is to try to educate them a little bit. But it's not just Blue Water. Guam, the same thing. There are some good studies out there, okay? At the same time, there's a bunch of meandering narratives that people have put together that don't understand how to put a litigation package together. And David, I know as an attorney, you'll agree with me. If you don't put the proper preparation into your litigation package, you're not going to win.
Right, right. But, John, give us your website, if you would, since I know you've mentioned that there's some good resources there for our listeners.
Yeah, www.militaryveteransadvocacy.org. And most of what I've got up there is under Blue Water. I have some other stuff. And hopefully over the Christmas holidays, I'm going to be able to post some more up on Guam and some of the other issues that we're looking at. Because this whole toxic exposure problem is something that needs to be addressed. It's not... as I said, the Blue Water Navy is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah, we've had on our prior shows, we had... go ahead, Richard. Richard,
yes,
go ahead.
I was going to ask you, I know we've been talking a lot about, you know, our vets and everything that's going on with them, compensation, and we're getting close to the end of the show here. What can you tell us about the current search for a new VA Undersecretary for Benefits?
What I understand happened, and this is rumor and innuendo, okay, is that a name was presented to the president, and the president turned it down, okay? And I understand that the president was very uncomfortable with this person who had been in the VBA for a long, long time. okay? And that's about all the details I can go into. So therefore, they launched a current search or another search. There's a search committee that's headed by Tom Bowman, who's the deputy VA secretary. And, you know, they're reviewing resumes, CVs, and are supposed to make a decision coming up sometime in December. So, you know, that's all I know. If anybody's interested, you can go to USA Jobs, and the position was listed there. Okay.
John, let me go back briefly on the toxic exposure issue. We had a guest a few months ago about Camp Lejeune. I know earlier this year the VA came out with their finalized regulation with a list of 8 diseases and cancers on their now presumptive list for the contaminated drinking water at Camp Lejeune. And somehow the VA has decided they'll be able to fund that, which I think they've estimated to be a couple $1 billion, maybe more, who knows.
Sure.
You think that's going to help as some sort of a precedent to persuade Dr. Shulkin that they need to do the same things? They need to find a way to do the same thing for the Blue Water Navy veterans from Vietnam?
Well, what they did was you had Senator Burr and Senator Teltz from North Carolina basically put it in and force that money into the budget so that so Secretary Shulkin was able to go along with that. But that's been, but even at that, I believe there's only 8 diseases that have been, or disabilities that have been funded. And
yeah,
talking about there should be about 11 more. I'm not sure who your guest was. Jerry Emsinger down there has been a very important voice. His 9-year-old daughter died from the contamination of the water down there. He's been a very important voice in pushing this issue. But it's an issue that still needs to be pushed. Part of the problem, David, is we don't know at this point what all the impacts of toxic exposure are. And we've been trying to do this piecemeal. Now, last Congress, there was a bill passed, the Toxic Exposure Research Act. And it originally called for a central center of excellence to be established to go through and look at all kinds of toxic exposures. That got stripped out of the bill at the end. And when I talked with Secretary Shulkin in October, he seemed to think, and I recommend it. Of course, I don't know how I don't know how effective my recommendations are, but I recommended that they go ahead and adopt that, even though it's not in the statute. And he seemed very interested in that concept. You know, this kind of goes back to what the Australians do. If you remember, the Australians are the ones that started the Blue Water Navy issue, and the reason they did was because they actively tracked the health of every veteran from the time they left the service. They're the ones who first saw an increase in cancer incidence among the Blue Water Navy at about twice the rate of the folks that fought, you know, in country, and said, doesn't make sense. And they went to find out why. And if we were to adopt that same type of situation where we had a research center set up that could give grants to medical schools, to environmental groups, whatever, okay, to go out and, you know, study these effects, you know, I think we have a much better system. Because right now, at best, the VA is reactive, at best. And quite frankly, they're not very reactive at all. So, you know, it's a system that needs to be completely revamped. And I'm going to say this, too, and I don't know what your thoughts are on Secretary Shulkin. He's been in office now for, 10 months. I think the guy is trying. I think his heart's in the right place. But he's just, you know, got such a humongous mess. And, you know, when you look at some of the stuff he started doing in medical with Teladoc and so on and so forth, I think he's making some good strides. And that's his area of expertise, is medical. He knows almost nothing about the Veterans Benefits Administration. Not his fault, okay? He's just never had any experience in it. And, you know, when you talk to the guy about benefit situations, he's like a sponge. I mean, he's just trying to soak it all up and find and learn about it as fast as he can. So
right.
The problem is, I think a lot of people expect a miracle overnight, and he's just not going to get it. He's got a great big problem there, and he's going to probably, if he stays there for 8 years, I suspect that he'll get a lot of it changed, but you know, at the expense of a lot of gray hairs and ulcers. In fact, I told him, I said, "Man, you got a lot more gray hair than you did when I saw you in April." And he laughed. He said, "Yeah, I sure do." But
yeah.
You know, he's trying.
Yeah. Well, I applaud him for that. We're trying to on back to the Iraq and Afghanistan burn pit issue. I've been trying to get some people we have connected up in Washington to get him to watch this new burn pit documentary called Delay, Deny, Hope You Die, How America Poisoned Its Soldiers by director and producer Greg Lovett. So I'll send you stuff on that, and maybe if you get a chance to. I know you've got so much on your plate already to talk to him about, but that's an issue we're trying to get his attention on. So like you said earlier, so that these veterans aren't waiting 70 years from now to get any sort of presumptive. You know,
well, I'll tell you what, David. When we went up this last time, I took a guy with me who was a Guam veteran and also a Fort McClellan veteran. Okay, and he'd heard a little bit about Fort McClellan. He had no idea about Guam. I mean, that was just complete new information for him. So I don't know when I'm going to ask for another meeting, and he may never even give me another meeting. I don't know, but my thought is to probably try to get something maybe next April, kind of at the 6 month point. So stay in touch, and if you're up to DC, maybe you can come with me.
That would be great. Yeah, I think Richard and I would both welcome that opportunity.
Jump at the opportunity, John.
Yeah. The VA police aren't shooting at me anymore, so
Well, that's good to know. I think Richard and I have made more than our share of maybe enemies is too strong of a word, but certainly those that in the St. Pete regional office that we deal with, you know, all the time. That they probably
That's got to be the worst one, St. Pete.
No, it's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. And the leadership they're smart enough that I can only infer that they really don't care. That their system is so poorly managed. So,
It was our group. We were one of the sponsors of the protest on November 9th out of Bay Pines.
Oh, okay. Yes, I saw those signs that day. I saw the signs, yep. Out there on Bay Pines Boulevard, yep.
We had that. And Steve Andrews at WFLA there in Tampa has been very supportive on all what we're trying to do. We call him the Veterans Voice.
Yeah, they've got a couple good reporters on that station and a couple other ones, as well as the Tampa Bay Times newspaper, Howard Altman, good on covering military issues. But now, before we run out of time tonight, I wanted to ask you to share with our listeners one more time how our listeners can support your organization, where they can find out more information, those kinds of things.
Well, www.militaryveteransadvocacy.org. That's one word, Military Veterans Advocacy. Or follow us on Facebook at Military Veterans Advocacy. As far as support goes, we do try to read the IMs, personal messages, the notes on all the Facebook. I won't say we're 100%, but we're trying. If anybody's interested in financial support, we are tax-free donation, or you can make a tax-free donation at www.militaryveteransadvocacy.org, and we do take Visa, MasterCard, Discover. And also,
very
if
good.
You prefer a check, there's an address to send it to as well. So, you know, we try to, and you know, it's, I don't take a salary. Nobody on the board takes a salary, and none of our volunteers, they're not employees really, none of our volunteers take a salary. And, you know, we do like to get our expenses paid for. Those park benches get cold about this time of year, especially with snow on them. So Right. And, you know, we do have to fly up to D.C., and D.C., you know, it's just not cheap. Okay, we do the
right.
best we can. But our financial statements are also posted on our website every, at the end of every year. So,
well, that's good to know.
And I hope the money goes.
Yep. Well, that's good to know, and I hope our listeners will support it. It's a tremendously worthy cause, and we wish you the greatest of success, and hope to stay in touch. And if we can join with you in any efforts and join with you on a trip to D.C., we certainly look forward to that. And I'll be sending you some stuff tomorrow on this burn pit thing in case it'd be of interest. But we thank you so much for being on our show, John, and appreciate everything you've told us. Before we go, any last thoughts or comments, anything you'd like to add?
Yeah, this toxic exposure issue is something that really needs more and more emphasis. So those of you that are listening, send in a letter to your member of Congress, not just Blue Water, not just Guam, but for all the toxic exposure issues. Or write a letter to your newspaper, okay? Please, you know, just take the time, write, you know, 200-word letter and just explain why it's so important. Try to learn a little bit about it, how the system works. If you go on to the Hill's website and if you Google the articles that I wrote, we try to kind of explain the financial and the fiscal issues, because, you know, we always go there, we always win the scientific battle, we always win the moral battle, we always lose the fiscal battle. So, you know, some of the emphasis saying, hey, Congress, you need to pay for the veterans. Stop paying for some of this other garbage that you're paying for. Start paying for the
right.
veterans.
Right. Well, I think that's great. That's a great note to end on. And we'd like to thank John Welch for being on our show, the Veterans News Hour. Again, I hope you will. You have an open invitation. Come back anytime you like, John. So,
all right.
Again.
Appreciate it, man.
Take care.
You take care.
Thanks, John.
God bless you, and God bless all our veterans.
Yes, thank you. Good night.
Good night now.
Well, Richard, that was great. I'm glad John was able to be with us, and I know you and I have lots to share with him, and maybe we can join him on a trip to D.C. We're drawing rapidly to our close, Richard, so why don't I turn it over to you?
Sure, David. Once again, I'd like to remind our family members of the Coaching Into Care program. If you are a family member of a veteran who has left the service and is having a tough time transitioning to civilian life, please be aware of the VA's program called Coaching Into Care. It helps veterans having difficulty transitioning to home life. Returning home can be a tough adjustment, and loved ones can help. Coaching Into Care offers free coaching to help your veteran. Give the program a call at toll-free 1-888-823-7458. Its hours are Monday through Friday, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Again, the VA's Coaching Into Care number is 1-888-823-7458. In addition, I'd like to once again remind listeners that if you're a veteran who is suicidal or in a crisis of any kind, the U.S. Department of Veteran Affairs also has the Veterans Crisis Line to help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. Many veterans have committed suicide because they did not get the help they need. Help them get the care they need to cope with their problem. Once again, the Veterans Crisis Line can help. Call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1. David, why don't you take us out?
Thanks. So I'd like to thank our special guest, John Welch. Thank our show sponsors, American Legion Post 303, Mr. Charles Newman, and Corey and Hurley Law Group. And thank our producer here at BBS Radio, Mr. Doug Newsom. I'd like to thank everyone for listening in tonight, and we hope you'll tune in next week, same time, same station, for another edition of the Veterans News Hour. Until then, have a happy Thanksgiving and a great week ahead. Good night.
Thank you for listening to the Veterans News Hour with David Corey and Richard Hurley. We hope you found this week's program very informative. Be sure to invite your friends and all the veterans you know to tune in next week, when we'll have another great show on veterans issues. Meanwhile, you can listen to our other recorded episodes on the Veterans News Hour webpage on VBSRadio.com. Thanks again for listening to the Veterans News Hour.